This is January 20th, 2013. And for Teisho this morning, I'm going to comment on an article that I commented on long, long ago and have kept ever since because it's so good. It's about commitment. And this article appeared in the publication, the periodical of another Buddhist center. It's called Inquiring Mind, is the name of the periodical. It's a Vipassana, I think, a Vipassana Buddhist periodical. But the author is Susan Moon, is at the time was a Zen Buddhist. Excuse me. The name of the article is Thinking About Commitment. It's so well written that there'll be stretches where I'll just read from what she says, but then other times I'll comment on it. Commitment is not a particularly Buddhist concept, but it is certainly a concept which bears on Buddhist practice. When I hear the word commitment, I think first of the context of intimate relationships, marriage being the most obvious example. But of course we can speak also of commitment to work or to a spiritual practice, among other things. We're familiar with Freud's definition of mental health as the ability to love and to work. That's a famous summation of mental health, someone who can love and work. And she says, and I would add to that a third sphere of human endeavor, and that would be the ability to have some kind of life of the spirit. In all three of these areas, I believe that the concept of commitment has relevance. What do we actually mean by commitment? I like the word wholeheartedness, which is perhaps a more Buddhist way to think about the same thing. The word commitment implies engagement with an activity over a long period of time. Wholeheartedness implies a depth of engagement at a given moment in time. Maybe we could say that commitment is a horizontal kind of engagement, and wholeheartedness is a vertical kind of engagement. Horizontal meaning over the time-space continuum, and vertical meaning the depth at any particular moment. Harada Roshi, with his introductions to Zen practice, he would sometimes, according to Roshi Kaplow, he would sometimes draw a vertical line, and then through it he would draw a horizontal line. And the horizontal line meant space, and the vertical line meant time, and at the intersection is where we all find ourselves, this moment, now, here. And that at this moment, we, in a sense, we are all time and all space. What she's talking about here, I think, is a very important distinction she's making, that commitment is based on an impulse to stick with something over time, whereas wholeheartedness we can bring. It's just based on the moment, but she develops it further. Am I committed to Buddhist practice? I started sitting at the Berkeley Zen Center 13 years ago. I have often been uncertain, wondered whether it was right for me. I've been beset by doubts. Somewhat unaccountably, after 8 years of practice, I felt ready to have what we call lay ordination. That is, to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, take the 10 precepts, the 4 vows, and receive a Dharma name. This is here we just call going, taking, receiving the precepts, going to Jukai, which we have twice a year, a Memorial Day weekend and Thanksgiving weekend. I've never liked the term lay ordination because it strikes me as an oxymoron. There is this steady in semantic inflation that we see happening in this country, where you hear references at some Zen centers, references to the trainees, those in training at the Zen centers, as monks, when they have not taken any lifelong commitment and vows of celibacy or anything else. But the idea, I guess, at these centers is that if you're in training, you're a monk. You're living a monastic lifestyle, and there's something to that. I think when we go to Sesshin, where every one of us in Sesshin is living like monks or nuns, living like monastics for that week. It's a week of monasticism. But it blurs the commitment. Yeah, it is a commitment that has traditionally been part of true monastic ordination in China, where you become, when you receive full ordination, you take vows of celibacy and homelessness. That is, you don't you cut your ties to family and completely submit yourself to the discipline, the structure of the monastic life. Here we have what we call priests. I reject the term monks because, as in most Zen centers in the United States and Zen temples and monasteries in Japan, becoming ordained, you still have the choice, the option of getting married. And most priests, after an initial stretch of training at a monastery, they do become married, I understand, in Japan, and I think it's largely true here too. So that's already we're using ordination in a pretty broad way, where you can still get ordained, still get married. So then to call it lay ordination, I think, is confusing. So we don't use it here. But we just say taking Jukai, receiving the precepts formally. You notice she says here, referring to lay ordination, is to taking refuge in the 3 treasures, taking the 10 precepts, the 4 vows. This was a big surprise to me at one of the early meetings of Zen teachers I attended, national meetings of Zen teachers, where I learned that at a lot of centers, they seldom take the 4 vows. They seldom recite, chant the 4 vows. I'm sure that gives them a different kind of power if you very seldom do it. But in our lineage, what we've always done here, and we get this from our predecessors in Japan, is to take the vows much more often, every day practically. The 4 vows, by the way, will end this teisho, this talk, by chanting the 4 vows. So I won't go through them now. Actually, I will bring them up later in terms of commitment. So after 8 years of practice, I felt ready to, let's say, receive the precepts. It was a subtle and unconscious transition for me, like finding oneself hungry and sitting down to a bowl of cold cereal. No big deal. No big decision. I didn't mean that I would do anything any differently from before. I was not becoming a priest. I would look just the same, but it was a way for me to make a statement to myself and to my community that I am committed. It was a way to let go of doubt, to make some room for wholeheartedness and faith. I felt different afterwards. I now say to myself and to anybody who asks me that I'm a Buddhist. Looking back, I have to conclude as a historian that yes, I must be committed to Buddhist practice just because I am still doing it. But can one be retroactively committed? This sounds like an easy way out. Can one even be committed to something without knowing it consciously? I think she's right, to just come to the conclusion that if you've been doing something long enough that, well, you must have been committed. I mean, fair enough, it's just one's track record says more than anything else. But I think it blurs the definition of commitment. I see commitment as a conscious, forward-looking kind of pledge, if not a formal pledge, a sense of a real commitment. We just started one of our biannual term intensives for very briefly for people who don't know what I'm talking about. It's a period of several weeks where people are invited to make a commitment to somehow step up their practice, their Zen practice, in one way or another. I think that it should begin with increasing the sitting one does, increasing the daily sitting or the sitting one does in a week. And then beyond that, people make other pledges in addition related to self-discipline and self-discipline, cutting certain things out that they want to be free of for those few weeks. And the key element is commitment. And then accounting, holding oneself accountable. It's a tricky business because you want to stretch a little bit. And say if you've been sitting half an hour a day, then you want to do more than half an hour a day, but you don't want to bite off more than you can chew, because then you don't live up to your commitment. So over the years, I've learned that this is the real, in a way, this is the hard part about the term intensive, is finding something you can do to stretch your involvement with practice, self-discipline, without stretching it to the breaking point where you find that you just can't keep up with it, you can't do it. But it's based on that initial pledge. Okay, I'm going to make it an hour a day. Whatever it takes, I'm going to do that. Or I'm going to do whatever, yoga every day for at least 20 minutes, or whatever it takes. Because if you have an out, if you start fudging it and not taking the commitment seriously, then it just loses its value, of course. She gets into that, too. This thing about, I now say to myself, and to anybody who asks me that I'm a Buddhist, I say to new people especially, there's no need to think of yourself as a Buddhist. I've said this before in Taisho, suppose if someone came to your door, a census taker, and said, religion, this we've got Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, well then, yeah, you might want to say Buddhist. But otherwise, why carry around that image or that notion of oneself as anything special as any kind of ist. It kind of goes sort of contrary to Zen, the spirit of Zen. We want to not cling to any notions about ourselves, any categories of ourselves. Although, again, there may be a time to do that, but otherwise, who needs that? Who needs to think of oneself as a Buddhist? She goes on, I know from painful experience that in personal relationships you can't make yourself be wholehearted. I've tried. What a terrific guy. He's single, straight, and considerate. I should fall in love with him. It doesn't work. You can't make yourself feel certain things, no matter how much you want to feel them. But if you can't just decide to be wholehearted, can you just decide to be committed? This is, I think she's come to a very important distinction here. But I'll read some more. Perhaps if you make a commitment, the wholeheartedness will come after, in the space you've safeguarded with the commitment, like a plant in a fenced garden, like an arranged marriage. Or must both commitment and wholeheartedness grow without being pushed, unnoticed, organically, like mushrooms in the dark? I like this image, in the space you've safeguarded with the commitment. I suppose that every time we cross our legs to sit, it is something like making a commitment. All right, I'm going to do my level best now. I'm committed to the practice I'm working on, the breath practice or the koan, whatever it is. That's my commitment for these next 35 minutes. And then from that, hopefully, comes the wholeheartedness where you're actually engaged fully with it. An arranged marriage. This has always intrigued me. You know, this is just standard operating procedure in many countries, including the two biggest, China and India, the two most populous, where you're just told who you're going to marry, and they find through statistics that those marriages work out. At least as well, they stick at least as well as our Western style choice based marriages. It's an intriguing thing. You don't know someone until you meet them at the altar, and somehow most of them stay together. Most of these couples stay together. And it comes, I think, from the importance of taking vows. If you take a vow seriously, then you find a way to make it work. If you take it seriously. If you don't take it seriously, then you can find all kinds of ways of letting it slide. I'm not criticizing those who get divorced, and I keep finding myself coming up with a thought right before she says it, so I'll wait and let her say this. But just a little personal anecdote. Before I became ordained as a priest, Roshi Kaplow was ordaining people as celibate monks. He didn't want to give people the option, or people he ordained, we want them to have the option of marrying. And there were three people here on staff who took vows, monastic vows, true monastic vows of celibacy and all. I was almost there. I was, you know, I came to the altar to be ordained as a monk, and then had a change of mind and really felt that I just couldn't. I couldn't see not being able to visit my family again. That was really the main thing, and so I backed out of it. And then Roshi decided that he would adopt this more common style of ordination, where you did have the option of getting married. But in those days before I asked Roshi to ordain me as a monk, I would talk to one of the monks here at the time, who was a celibate monk, and I was really struggling. I said, "How do I know if it's my karma to be a celibate monk?" And I'll never forget his answer, which I think is profound. He said, "You make it your karma. That's the point of a vow. Okay. This is it. I'm going to find a way to make this work and stick with it." She continues, My strongest experience of wholeheartedness and commitment in personal relations is as a parent. My children are almost grown up now, and the unhesitating commitment their presence has called forth from me, from the very bottom of my heart, has surely been one of the liberating experiences of my life. It's easier for me to be wholehearted when there's no choice, no exit. Yeah, with children, you can't just make them go away when you've had it with them. And so in a way, that's the airtight commitment, although of course one can just disappear, one can abandon one's children. When I think of being a parent, although I'm not a parent, I have these words of William James, the author of Religion and Psychology. He said, it is only by risking our persons from one hour to another that we live at all. Beyond the very extremity of fatigue and distress, we may find amounts of ease and power we never dreamed ourselves to own, sources of strength never taxed at all because we never push through the obstruction. So this can apply to parenting. I think of the sleepless nights that parents go through with young children, sometimes the sleepless nights they go through with teenagers, and it also sesshin. This is sort of a real call to arms for what is possible in sesshin, what we discover about ourselves by having committed. That's why we have always had on the sesshin application form at the bottom, we've had the requirement that you sign a statement saying, if accepted to this sesshin, I will complete it. Now that we have online applications, If you're submitting an application online, you can't sign it, of course, but there's something similar that we do. And then in those rare times when someone comes to me during sesshin and says, "I can't do this, I have to leave," I try desperately to keep them in, to keep them from leaving, so that they can find out that it's mostly mental. They're wanting to leave. They're losing heart is mostly a mental thing that can be overcome. And then if necessary, they still say, no, I have to leave. Then I point out to them that they did commit to staying the whole sesshin. This is for their sake, for the person's sake, so that she or he can discover experientially that you get through these things, these doubts, this self-doubts that, that can sometimes prompt people to want to leave Sesshin. As for Buddhist practice, I think you can't just decide to be wholehearted about that either. But what you can do is put yourself into certain situations which foster wholeheartedness, which force you to burn yourself up, leaving nothing behind. Well, again, Sesshin, I would say also being in residential training here at the center and staff and the staff program or just some length of residential training, there's not much room for separating yourself when there's such a strong structure of things that you're required to do, the sittings and the work and other things. And just putting oneself into that kind of structure, which is a way to, it forces you to leave nothing behind, get yourself wholeheartedly into it. The alternative is to be miserable. If you're, whether it's Sesshin, that's the purest such context, or residential training, if you're wobbling about it, if you find yourself having doubts and thoughts about this and that, then that's when it's more painful. But when you just throw yourself into it, then it becomes something that's, you transcend it. This is the value of physical pain. Everyone knows this who's been to, certainly to Sesshin, but even regular sittings, that physical pain kind of demands that you get concentrated on your practice. Because if you're not, if your mind is slack or you're wobbling with thoughts, then it'll be more painful. So that's how we use pain. How it can be used is as a way of kind of as a lever to kind of force us to become really absorbed in the breath practice or the koan practice. And then we discover that we can transcend the pain and find a whole new relationship to the pain that is where it's less of a problem. So our rule of no moving during a round of sitting, which by the way doesn't apply to now, Taisho, people are free to change posture during Taisho if they need to. But otherwise, the rule of no moving is a form of commitment. It's the same thing as signing the Sesshin application form. If you don't have a way out, then you'll discover all kinds of resources, personal resources and strength and faith that you wouldn't have otherwise. She continues, playing the Mokugyo for chanting, for example, sitting Zazen, it's so easy for me to lose my concentration, to sleep, to daydream, to plan. But when I'm playing the Mokugyo, that's this fish-shaped wooden drum here near the altar that we were just hearing during chanting. But when I'm playing the Mokugyo, I can't think about what I'll cook for dinner. I am completely wholehearted, beating the drum, beating the Mokugyo, and chanting the Prajnaparamita, and the drum, the Mokugyo itself, seems to be my heart. I am no more beating the Mokugyo than I am beating my heart. Well, this is what people in any kind of demanding physical endeavor discovers, whether it's traditional sports or extreme sports is that when you have to pay attention, then you lose yourself. You discover that you can transcend the self. This, I'm convinced, is what draws people back again and again to very demanding sports and extreme sports. It's just a way to reach a state of self-transcendence or self-forgetfulness, because you have no choice. She uses the example of rock climbing. I used to do rock climbing, and the wonderful thing about it, too, was the wholeheartedness which it required. Definitely no daydreaming as I clung by my fingernails to a pimple of granite in the sky, but rather a quite enthusiastic feeling of commitment to staying alive. The challenge, of course, is to be wholehearted about our humdrum everyday lives lived at sea level. Yeah, and that is. It's demanding enough to throw yourself into some risky sport or other kind of activity. But the real challenge is bringing that level of absorption, of intense concentration, of living in the moment, bringing that to the most ordinary things, shoveling snow or driving or stirring the soup. This is what Zen practice is about, because those athletes and those risk takers, they can reach that state of self-transcendence for that activity, that specific activity of rock climbing or hang gliding or whatever, but then surely find it much more difficult to be that in the moment with these ordinary daily activities. And that's what Zen practice offers, is the training of the mind so that we can bring that degree of absorption into the most ordinary, so-called banal, mundane kinds of activities. It does work. It takes time to develop that. Yesterday in the introductory workshop, I talked about scrubbing pots. I was assigned to scrub pots once during Sesshin, and how it was a really liberating experience to see that even that tiresome, what had always been tiresome, a job, you could change your relationship to it through zazen, through a lot of sitting. It's so much of it is just getting beyond self-consciousness. In a way, it's all about self-consciousness. I don't mean just in the ordinary sense of the word self-consciousness, where you know things that teenagers feel so terribly self-conscious, but getting beyond our consciousness of the self as a separate entity apart from others. These words of Satchel Paige, the great pitcher, baseball pitcher, came to me when I was thinking of this kind of wholeheartedness that we need to bring to everything to lose this self-consciousness. He says, work like you don't need the money, love like you've never been hurt, dance like nobody's watching. Great prescription for a life really fulfilled. She says, just to go on here about bringing this wholeheartedness to everyday lives lived at sea level, and every moment that my whole heart is beating within me is another opportunity to be wholehearted, or to recognize that I already am wholehearted. This is our natural condition. And by natural, I mean here not the ordinary state of the average person, but the kind of attention that we are capable of in our true nature. We know that children don't have to be taught to be absorbed in what they're doing. That's what I mean by natural. We come that way. We're designed that way to be absorbed in our lives and not separated and lost in thoughts. So Zen practice is just a way to get back to our natural abilities by learning to not cling to random, irrelevant thoughts. I have studied hand bookbinding, and in bookbinding, the word commit is used when you're pasting two surfaces together. Let's say you are making the book cover. You have your book cloth all measured and cut. You have your cardboard all measured and cut. You brush the paste on the cloth. You brush the paste on the cardboard. Then you pick up the limp cloth and hold it exactly over the cardboard, which will become your book cover. And when you're ready, you commit it. That is, you lay it down in one smooth, unhesitating movement. If you stop in the middle and wonder what you're doing, it will stretch or wrinkle or buckle or warp. So you just jump in and go for it with your whole heart. The worst that can happen is that you may have to do it over, but if you waver and are tentative, you will surely have to do it over. This is all, you know, just all material for doing Zazen. So the important thing is to be wholehearted at the moment that you are doing something. The idea that you are committing yourself to something that stretches way ahead of you into the future is perhaps not so helpful. Or maybe we focus too much on that aspect of commitment, the part that goes on over time. Two people can commit themselves to each other very sincerely with the idea that it is for a long time, even forever, or a person can commit herself wholeheartedly to a new job. And in the moment these commitments are made, they are made wholeheartedly. Then things change. Unforeseen circumstances arise. The people change. The couple separates. The person leaves the job. Does that mean the commitments were in any way false? What counts is making the commitment now, without covering over the wholeheartedness with too many layers of ideas. Yeah, I agree. People who have a hard time making a marriage commitment, people who, let's say, live together for years and just can't commit to taking marriage vows, it may be, I don't know, it may be that they're fretting about it too much, thinking about it too much. That's, I think, what she's warning us about. On the other hand, the four vows themselves are committing to something over time. Psychological research has shown that the more emphasis you put on a particular goal, the more likely it is that when you achieve that goal, you'll quit, you'll slacken in your efforts. So I've always felt that the real goal for all of us, every one of us, is full enlightenment, supreme, perfect enlightenment. Now, if after reaching that you want to quit, go ahead. And so we take the four vows, as we will in just a few minutes, where we set our sights way, way into the future and recognize that that's something worth working for our whole lives and lifetime after lifetime, but not carrying that around as a thought. There's the aspiration. We can have the aspiration to come to enlightenment for the sake of all beings, not just to get a badge, but come to enlightenment for the sake of all beings. That's our underlying aspiration, perhaps. But then not to just be chewing on that all the time. But, you know, of course, the way to achieve that is to be wholehearted in each moment and not be thinking about this distant goal of enlightenment. One way to think of commitment is the phrase, whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. That's true commitment. That's what Sesshin calls for. Finishing it, whatever it takes. Except for, you know, some serious medical issue that's natural, that we just have to bail on that. But she makes a good point about marriage and divorce, is that we do change. That's the thing of it. You make a sincere commitment to your partner, but then she changes, you change, he changes, and so it's important, I think, to be realistic about commitments, and you do your very best to live up to it and to follow it through to the very end, but at the same time, the person 20 years into marriage is not the same person as the one who made took those marriage vows. I shudder to think that I'm giving someone reason to just bolt from a marriage rather than sticking it out and getting psychotherapy or something to make it work. But to be fair, it is. There are two sides to this. A little more from her. Commitment has been an issue for me in terms of my work as well. I have worked at a number of things in my life, in the fields of publishing, education, and political activism. I have suffered a great deal from my own uncertainty and changing focus. I've always wanted to write. I've always dibbed and dabbed at it, but I never, at the deepest level, committed myself to it, because I was afraid. And then she goes on and says how she overcame that. I don't. There's no time. We got to end now. But just a little more. She says we have to focus on one project at a time and do that with full attention until it's completed. Then it's time to do the next thing. One thing has a way of leading to another. If you keep walking along a path, you get somewhere. You can always change your course as you go along, depending on the weather conditions, an unexpected rock slide, a beautiful lake that wasn't on the map. I have made a leap of faith that if I follow my heart, the other things will fall into place. So faith is connected to commitment and wholeheartedness. Of course it is. Faith tides you over when wholeheartedness flags. The days when I sit at my desk and I can't think of anything to say, or I don't like what I can think of, I have faith that it's going to be all right, that I'm doing what I need to be doing. Same thing with practice, of course. There are always going to be dry periods where we feel like we're going through the motions, we've got our legs crossed, but things just aren't flowing. That's where you have to draw from faith, that faith in the process. I say this over and over in Sesshin, trust the process. Trust the long-term work. There are always going to be down periods, but think long-term, stick with it, and you will prevail. Buddhist practice has helped me to make this commitment. It has helped me with what looks like self-discipline, but which, oddly, is really the kind of faith I was just talking about. It's what keeps you from getting up and leaving the zendo in the middle of the sesshin, even though your knees hurt, or you're bored, or sleepy, or claustrophobic. It's what keeps you from leaving your desk to do the laundry, even though you can't think of anything to say. I suppose it's what keeps you from leaving your husband, even though you just had a fight about whose turn it is to drive the carpool. And Buddhist practice has helped me to be wholehearted about being me, from one moment to the next. I'm going to close with a kind of a prose poem that appeared on the back of an issue of our periodical Zenbo, the Rochester Zen Center's periodical Zenbo, that landed in my mailbox when I was still living in Ann Arbor. Before I came to the center, I had begun sitting. I was smitten with it. I knew that I'd be doing this the rest of my life. But it wasn't until I got this Zenbo and the poem on the back that I can't explain it. It just, reading that, I was so filled with inspiration that I made a couple hundred copies of it and stood out in the middle of the University of Michigan Diag, and just handed it out to everyone who came by. It was just enthralling. So I'm going to end with this. And the poem is by W.H. Murray. And then he ends by quoting Goethe. Here's what he says. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no one could have dreamt would have come his way. I have learned a deep respect for one of Goethe's couplets. Whatever you do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. So we'll stop now and recite the four vows.